So the court will be joined by Judge Horatio Wheelock of Douglas County. And Judge Wheelock will be joining us. Justice Castle will be presiding.
Thank you. We'll pause while the changes in personnel occur on the bench. And Judge Wheelock has now joined the bench. Mr. Von Lowe, you're here for the appellant.
Yes, Judge.
And Mr. Davidson, you're here for the appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
No, please.
Very well. Mr. Von Lowe, you may approach and proceed whenever you are ready.
All right. Thank you, Judge.
Justices, may it please the court. My name is Derek Von Lowe. I'm representing the appellant, Mr. Buttercase, here for oral argument. I think that there were numerous issues that were brought in the trial court here, that there are several errors. I think the first was the denial of the Mr. Buttercase's numerous attempts to attain a default judgment in this matter. I think, first of all, if you look at the history, there were several defaults that were made by the appellees in this case. And I think that although the court had given the appellees an opportunity to clean their error and be able to answer on their default, unfortunately, the appellees did not do that, especially after the second motion for default judgment was filed by Mr. Buttercase, and there was never an answer to that second amended complaint. And at the motion for default judgment on that hearing, there was no issue when the district court made the decision to go ahead and overrule the default judgment. There was no and gave the appellees another 14 days to answer after August of 2021. That never happened, and it didn't happen until Mr. Buttercase filed his third motion for default judgment. And then there was an answer that was given after that third filing of the motion for default judgment, of which the district court decided to go ahead and allow the matter to go forward on that third motion for default judgment. And
so,
then,
so was the answer on that third motion for default judgment on file by the time there was a hearing on that third motion for default judgment?
That's my understanding, that there it was on file by the time there was a hearing on the third motion.
That's the reason the judge gave for overruling the motion for default judgment.
Right. That yes. And I think that that's error. I think that we're looking at abuse of discretion here. I think that that's an error on the court's part. I think that after the second motion for default judgment that was filed, there was no answer that was filed. Nothing happened until after the court overruled that, had a hearing, overruled that, and then gave them an opportunity to answer.
Was there some allegation on that second motion to file judgment that the appellees were not served or didn't have notice of?
Not to my knowledge. I was not the trial. I was not the attorney at trial, so I'm not exactly.
Mr. Buttercase was representing himself.
He was representing himself at those hearings at that time. I do not believe that there was any kind of anything in the default motion that, or in the arguments that were made by the appellee, that they did not get service. I think there were some issues with service, but it seemed that Mr. Buttercase had taken care of those issues and had gotten proper service on the parties for those. And so I think, first of all, based upon that, I think that this matter should be remanded back to the district court for an entry of default judgment against the appellees based upon the abuse of discretion there.
I believe that standard goes on to say that
abuse of discretion has to be shown that the decision was based upon a tenable or reasonable basis, or its action is clearly against justice or conscious reason and evidence. Can you kind of tie that into why this would reach that standard?
Sure, and I think that, I think that after the second motion for default judgment was filed, there was a hearing, there was still no answer that was put on file at that time, and that the judge overruled that, allowed another 14 days, and then there was a third default by the appellees. They did not file their answer within the 14 days. I think that that amounts to that standard, and I think that gets us over that hill, as far as that goes.
If it were to go back, couldn't the appellees just make a motion to set aside the default judgment with the same answer that they filed, and wouldn't the court be obligated to vacate the default judgment?
Well, I don't think that they would be. I don't think the district court would be obligated to vacate the default judgment. I think that there is certainly an opportunity there for the court to do that. But I think that if it's remanded back, I think that once the default judgment is entered, I think that I think that it would be very difficult for appellees to make any type of an argument, especially after the third time around, that they would be able, that they could bring up some sort of a defense that maybe this matter wasn't, you know, they didn't have proper notice. There were some of those types of issues there. I think that after the third time, I think that I don't think that the district court would have the ability to just set that aside based upon their request to be able to file an answer out of time. The next issue was the regarding the summary judgment that was entered in this matter. I think that there were several evidentiary rulings that this court needs to look at based upon the district court down below. I think one of the issues that should be looked at was the regarding the expert's testimony or the expert affidavits that were offered at the summary judgment. I think that it was an abuse of discretion for the court to overrule Mr. Buttercase's affidavit and not allowing it in.
Was the affidavit the first disclosure of any type of who Mr. Buttercase's expert was going to be?
That's my understanding. That was the first time. And I think that although it was the first time and he did not comply with the order to disclose under the progression order, I still think that there was an ample opportunity for the court to allow Mr. Buttercase to have his arguments there. I think one of the concerns here is that if the affidavit of Mr. Davis was allowed into that hearing as an expert testimony, which I think it was, considered as expert testimony by the court as to the malpractice issue, I think that's an abuse of discretion if one party doesn't get that same advantage made to them of and there was no not disclosure by the appellees that Mr. Davis was going to be a expert witness. However, I will concede that yes, there were, I mean, obviously Mr. Davis being a party to the proceedings, there is, I mean, I think his affidavit or him doing an affidavit at the time would certainly be something that could be anticipated, but I still think that they didn't meet the requirements of the expert disclosure in according to the progression order, and therefore I think it's an abuse of discretion on that part of when the judge is not going to allow one party to do something but allows another party to do the exact same thing.
Quid pro quo.
Exactly. I would like to request the rest of my time be reserved for rebuttal. There are no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Steve Davidson here on behalf of Polo Davis and Tori Finley, the wife and daughter of James Martin Davis, who are sued in their capacities as personal representative and next of kin. The district court properly dismissed this claim of legal malpractice against a criminal defense lawyer because there was no issue of fact as to the plaintiff's actual innocence of the crime to which he pled guilty, which was production and transportation of obscene material for distribution in interstate commerce. Lots of what you just heard really don't matter if this actual innocence issue was correctly decided by the court below, and it was. It's an important matter of public policy in the state on two concepts, causation and representation. Causation because, as a matter of public policy, this court has concluded that the cause of a criminal convicted criminal defendant's damages is not the negligence of his lawyer, but the commission of his criminal act itself. And representation because we need people like James Bartle Davis to appear and defend people like Mr. Buttercase in matters of this nature, and to subject those persons to this kind of proceeding in the absence of actual innocence is likewise a matter of strong public policy, really adopted everywhere in the country.
Mr. Buttercase alleges that his evidence, if received, would have shown his actual innocence to the charges that he was convicted of.
I would disagree. I think his evidence, is, and really as well as the Mr. Lowe's affidavit as an expert, that all went to the malpractice question. Was there negligence by Mr. Davis in the course of his representation? That's a separate element than actual innocence. Actual innocence goes to really a question of factual absence of committing the acts that led to the guilty plea.
Well, he was charged with child pornography, and his
was.
Wife testifies or makes a statement to the sentencing hearing that she's of age at the time the photos were taken.
Right.
He alleges that that would be a defense to the charge of child pornography. He was charged with that but never convicted of that offense.
Correct. The offense to which he pled guilty was different and did not include the age of the person in the images and any relationship between that person and Mr. Buttercase have no relationship whatsoever and are irrelevant to the crime for which he pled guilty, which is 18 U.S.C. 1465, producing, distributing obscene material in interstate commerce. And
he now alleges that he didn't share the images with anyone. They were maintained and viewed only in his own home with his wife.
So
therefore, he couldn't be convicted of the other offense.
You know, it exhibits 25 and 26 are the signed petition to plead guilty and the plea agreement in which Mr. Buttercase acknowledged a factual basis for that underlying charge, including his production of 5 videos and over 900 images, which he acknowledged intending to transport and distribute in interstate commerce. So to say that, you know, you get a comeback months later in a malpractice case against your lawyer and throw in an affidavit that, no, I didn't do it, and it was just in my house, I think the judge was well within her discretion to find that such evidence, even if admitted, would not generate a material issue of fact of consequence sufficient to avoid summary judgment on the actual innocence piece of the claim. The other reason that matters, Judge, is because a legal defense like that, like the person's not was too old or my intent was not to distribute or whatever, those are insufficient to avoid this actual innocence element because in the Marie case, it was explained that that element really goes to the person not being there at all, you know, convicting the wrong person, a factual defense to commission of a crime, and nowhere does Mr. Buttercase suggest that he did not, you know, engage in the activity for which he ultimately pled guilty.
And obviously, these facts were known to Mr. Buttercase at the time he entered his plea. Is that
he acknowledged that in the plea agreement and the petition to plead guilty. I mean, the questions you go through include acknowledgement of that exact those facts and these issues.
What about the default judgments?
So
there were three motions for default judgments, all denied.
That begins with Mr. Davis's initial response to the initial pleading, which was a motion to dismiss. So from that point, district judge knows there's obvious intent to appear and defend. Now, did Mr. Davis, was he late on answers? Yes. What were there service and notice issues in connection with many of those pleadings? Yes, the judge went through that in one of her orders. You know, the mail came to, I think, three or four different addresses out of the penitentiary. Mr. Davis, at a later hearing, said, I didn't get any of that stuff. There was a, supposedly a certified mail that went to a office that Mr. Davis supposedly was at, was signed by a person that Mr. Davis indicated, I have no idea who that is. And I think what happened ultimately is, because of that initial motion to dismiss, and because Mr. Buttercase continued to plead over himself, you know, we got to the, he would file a motion for default and then amend. The judge knew, and many of these hearings happened without Mr. Davis on the phone, or otherwise present, which he obviously would have been had he known. You know, there was simply no basis for default in a circumstance like that where the defendant is appearing, participating, actively defending against the case, notwithstanding the late answers.
The last default judgment, at the time that motion was filed, was there an answer on file?
I believe so.
At the time the motion was filed?
No, not the motion. Between the motion and the hearing, Mr. Davis filed a responsive pleading.
So by the time of the hearing?
I believe so, yes. By the time of the hearing in which he appeared on these and other related issues, yes, he had filed the pleading, had long confirmed his intention to appear, and raised defenses that are obviously legitimate to the claims being raised. The district judge was, we would suggest, well within her discretion to allow the case to proceed.
Did Mr. Buttercase also attempt to allege a breach of contract theory in this case?
He did. And I think is resolved by the Gravel versus Schmidt case, where the court said that when the, you know, the gravamen of the claim is conduct of a lawyer, and there's no question that this is all, that breach of contract claim is all about, you know, what Mr. Davis did or didn't do in the course of the representation and when, whether he was entitled to withdraw his counsel or not.
Is the Gravel or Gravel case, was that in the context of deciding what statute of limitations to apply?
It was, and the, you know, the issue there, or the, I would say the procedure that the court was trying to avoid is somebody parsing out a cause of action to avoid an element that ought to apply. And in that case, it was statute of limitations. We would suggest here that's actual innocence. You can't avoid that by recharacterizing your claim against
the
lawyer.
That's what I'm wondering about. I mean, I'm imagining a scenario where criminal defendant enters into a contract with criminal defense lawyer and say, I'm going to give you, here's $100,000. You're going to represent me to completion. The lawyer does nothing at all.
Sure.
Doesn't hold up his end of the bargain. And would we say the actual innocence element ought to apply there? Because it seems like we have this public policy of we're not going to allow criminal defendants to profit off of conduct for which they were guilty of a crime.
Right.
But would we deprive them of a right to contractual recovery? I'm not sure the rationale.
Well, and I think the distinction is that the scenario you describe does not involve evaluation of the attorney's legal representation and his conduct as an attorney, because you never get there, assuming the lawyer does nothing. This is far from that case, because the issues around the fee involve things like, you know, payment to expert witnesses at the Frank hearing, issues about the relationship between Mr. Davis and his client that Judge Swart found were sufficient to permit him to withdraw, notwithstanding the stage of the case that he was in. So I don't know the answer if that fact pattern would appear. I think the policy behind actual innocence is awfully strong. But in this case, we're not close to that kind of a scenario, because the contract claim is so intertwined with Mr. Davis's conduct as an attorney. The last thing that I would offer, well, I guess I'm out of time. I will not offer anything more. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. How much rebuttal time remains?
1 minute, 52 seconds, Your Honor.
Very well, Mr. Von Lowell.
Great, thank you, Judge.
Justices, there are just a couple of things that I would like to address. I think the first is the actual innocence issue. That is something that Mr. Buttercase was certainly understood that was a material element that he was needing to prove. As to that, he filed a motion and requested a stay of the proceedings from the court until his federal habeas corpus proceedings were completed. I think that that was an abuse of discretion on the court. I think that under the Severs case, I think that it's very clear that a court should go ahead and bifurcate the case in that case, get two separate tracks for the civil case versus the criminal case, and that the civil case should have been put on a stay in order for Mr. Buttercase to pursue his other innocence claims that he has on his federal habeas corpus proceeding. And I think that that would have, if the court would have stayed the proceedings until the federal habeas corpus was done, I think that that would have resolved that issue. And at the time, depending on the outcome of the federal habeas corpus, that certainly would have answered the actual innocence issue, and that would have made that either moot or it would have made it a decided point. I think that on the malpractice issues, I think that there's an issue with requiring the actual innocence when you're looking at contract claims, and specifically, Mr. Buttercase did plead a contract claim separate from the malpractice claim. I understand that these claims can be very similar and can be very much together, but bottom line is I think that it was still an abuse of discretion on the part of the judge to not allow the stay to happen and to also not allow his contract claim to go forward separate from the malpractice issue. I don't think that it was all just a malpractice issue. I'm out of time unless you have more questions.
There's not.
All right. Thank you
very much.
Appreciate it.
The cause is submitted and counsel are excused and we're adjourned for the day.
All right. Thank you.